this event through a live stream, as well as many, many international viewers who will be following the video feed that can be found live on the startpage.com website. What does privacy mean to us? How do we value our privacy? When Edward Snowden found out about mass surveillance and mass spying, he felt he had no choice. He felt the only thing he could do, he needed to inform the people about it. He valued our privacy so much that he was willing to give up his own comfortable life as well as his freedom for it. And that's why we feel that he is our true privacy hero. You can imagine that when Mr. Snowden accepted our invitation from Startpage to be present here tonight, that we were both thrilled and really honored. I hope that both the movie and the discussion that will take place later on will add to our awareness about what the privacy challenges are in these modern times. I also hope that it will inspire us to actively defend our values and rights. I wish you all a very exciting evening tonight, and now I'd like to introduce you to the moderator of the evening, an excellent journalist and a well-known television broadcaster, Mr. Roderick Velo. Thank you.
So good evening to all the people, not only here in this wonderful theater of Tuschinski, but also welcome to all the people around the world who are looking now to our feed. We're very happy that everybody watches. We're going to talk to Mr. Snowden, and I hope that Mr. Snowden is already there. Mr. Snowden, are you there? Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden, we are very honored to have you here. We collected a lot of questions from all around the world, from the people here in the audience, and we put them in a couple of subjects, so we're going to start with those questions right away. But first, the movie. Did you saw the movie yourself?
I have, yes.
Yeah. And was it accurate, do you think?
Yeah, so of course it's a drama. So there are a lot of things that have been changed. Things like a number of different officials throughout my life in different positions were sort of translated into one big super. And just for the text, so they know I'm hearing myself being fed back on the line a little bit. But the thing that I was most concerned about with the film, the question that was really burning in my mind was, would they get the technology right? Would they get the policies right? Would they get the programs right? And how they're actually affecting our lives. What is mass surveillance? How does it actually work? How does the government justify it and claim that these things are not only legal, but are actually right? In this context, the movie is actually surprisingly accurate for a drama. And that was something that left me with a good feeling.
Yeah. Did you have a lot of contact with Oliver Stone for the movie?
Yeah, he came out several times and we spoke. I was able to meet with the lead actor as well, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is a wonderful guy. He's so warm, so charming. I thought we were just going to sort of talk about how things were, what his focus was, talk maybe a little bit about the politics behind how this all fit together and how this came to be. But he didn't tell me, but of course as an actor, what he was actually there for was to try to understand how I move, how I speak, my little mannerisms and things like that. And he tried to put that into the film.
Fantastic. Was the trick, the famous trick with the Rubik's Cube, when you left the NSA, was that real? Happened that in real life? Or is it just a way to, you know, to hide the real reason how you smuggled the chip?
Sure. So I have to be careful in answering this because there is still an ongoing FBI investigation into me. My country's government considers me to be a fugitive. So I'll say this carefully, but what Oliver Stone has said previously is that this is a device for the film because no one knows what really happened. But what I can say about in real life is I did give, prior to leaving Hawaii, everyone in my office a gift of a Rubik's Cube. So there are many, many Rubik's Cubes going in and coming out of these offices past the guards all the time. And that's about as far as I can go.
On this way, like this.
Yeah, well, yeah, the security wasn't quite so hardcore as they show in the film. But yeah, people did carry cubes.
Of course, we're going to ask you some questions about the new president-elect, Donald Trump. And the first question is from someone you probably absolutely know. It's Phil Zimmerman. He's the inventor of the encrypted email. Phil, can you come on the stage? No, he's on.
Okay.
I think. Yeah.
Okay. A couple of years ago, I went to Moscow to speak at a conference, and I thought maybe I'd figure out a way to be able to meet you, but that never came to pass. I saw Citizen 4, and I saw that, you know, as you were attempting to connect with Glenn Greenwald with PGP. And he couldn't be bothered to learn how to use PGP. My impression was, go find another journalist. So, when I wrote the PGP manual about 25 years ago, I described in there the idea of that if we build a surveillance infrastructure like we seem to be doing, that it would could be used by a future government that could be elected in a democratic election, that could use it for their whatever evil purposes they might have. And I did the same thing in some Senate testimony in 1996. And, you know, I talk about that, and sometimes in a democracy, bad people can be elected. And if they inherit a technology infrastructure, a surveillance infrastructure, like what we've constructed, then they can use that to hang on to power. And I see that you made that point pretty clear in this story here. We now see that Trump will have a great deal of influence over what the NSA can do. Do you have any thoughts on that you'd like to elucidate on?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. First off, for people in the audience who may not be so familiar with Mr. Zimmerman's work, PGP is one of the original encryption schemes for email that I used in my original contact with the journalists. It's fair to say that the NSA revelations could not have happened in the way they did in 2013 without this man's work. So I have to say thank you very much for everything you've done, not just for myself, but for the world. But going on to the broader question here, I try not to look at this as a question of a single election or a single president or even a single government, right? Because we see these things, these threats coming across borders. We see the same thing happening in Russia. They've got this new surveillance law called the Yarovaya Package. Russians call it the Big Brother Law. In China, on the day of the election, the news was talking about how the Chinese had just passed a new mass surveillance law. And they got away with practically no criticism from the international community because they were clever enough to say that they had modeled it on the United States' own surveillance laws. And because our last two presidential administrations had been saying that these powers were so necessary, they were so valuable, and they didn't hurt anybody, now suddenly they can't criticize these other governments for doing the same thing. But this is a problem, because even if you think, all right, well, you know, we want government to have authority and powers to be able to perform its legitimate tasks of securing the nation, of protecting our communities, of investigating crimes, right? But how is this done, and where do they depart from this model? When do they start creating exceptions to what we have in the United States, our Fourth Amendment, which is an individual's right to privacy, where they say the government can't interfere in your communications, they can't arbitrarily investigate your home or take your letters or your emails, either collecting them or reading them, without going to a court and getting a warrant? But we have to recognize that even that barrier, the warrant requirement, the involvement of courts, doesn't mean the same thing in every country. If you say, well, mass surveillance is fine as long as the court's involved, Kim Jong-un in North Korea will go, oh, this is fabulous, because you know what? I have courts too. And they'll be happy to sign anything I put in front of them. And this is really something that we need to remember, is we are never farther than a single election away from a change in government, from a change in policy, from a change in the way the powers that we have constructed into a system are used. And so what we need to start thinking about now is not how do we defend against a President Donald Trump, but how do we defend the rights of everyone, everywhere, without regard to jurisdictions, without regard to the borders. We have this tremendous fabric of technology that we've enveloped the earth with. This internet that creates bonds of fraternity between people who don't even share the same language. But this fabric of communications that was intended to empower citizens and individuals of communities and families is increasingly being used to disempower them. Internet service providers, phone companies, governments, and other corporations are beginning to spy on these things. They're lifting up that fabric to look at the lives underneath, whether it is for the purpose of profit, or whether it's for the purpose of power, or whether it's for, in some cases, legitimate purposes. But we have to think for ourselves, what if we start weaving this fabric in a slightly different way? What if we start changing that dynamic mechanism that we face in the status quo today, which means when you pick up your phone, and you make a call to your mother, your sister, your husband, your wife, that call is transiting that global network electronically naked. Anybody can look at it, anybody can listen to it, anybody can read it. What if we change that so that it's protected by default? Every communication, every transaction you engage with is protected. And you don't have to take some activity. You don't have to teach a journalist how to use this sophisticated encryption program, even if it is 20 years old, and you know, you hope that people should be able to get to use it at this point. Instead, we made this fabric work not just for Americans, not just for people in the Netherlands, but for the whole world. If suddenly we could not just support the human rights of people in Germany, France, Brazil, Iran, Russia, China, in America, we could enforce them. We could guarantee them through our technology. And I think this election reminds us that that capability is within our reach today. And we have not just the right to try, but the duty.
You know, I've devoted my career to trying to create that capability. You know, end-to-end secure telephony is what I've been focused on in the last 12 years or so. I had the impression that you might have used something that I made for that too. You know, we went through a lot of trouble to wipe out our email encryption service on the same day that LavaBit did, for what we thought was probably for the same reason. I hope that that was a. I hope that that helped.
Edward Snowden, are you still there? Yes.
I am. Can you hear me? Have we lost?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
I can hear you.
Had a connection.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ralph Zimmerman.
Thank you so much for everything you've done.
I think we like to see Edward Snowden all the time, don't you? There he is. Edward Snowden, one more question about the president-elect, the elections. Did you follow the elections?
I did. I think everybody in the world did.
Yeah. So, is the outcome better or worse for your case?
You know, for me, I try to focus on the issues that matter the most here. And while I obviously care about what happens to me, I am the least important part of any of this. This is not about me. This is about us. And when I see these changes in government where we see these candidates who are extremely authoritarian, they believe that if we have the power to do something, we should do something. We stop thinking about wrong or right. We stop thinking about should or should not. And instead, we focus strictly on can or cannot. These, I think, are civic dangers to everyone. And these are the things that we have to focus the most on resisting, not individual cases, but broad social cases. And this is the thing that I think we begin to forget when we focus too much on a single candidate. The current president of the United States, President Barack Obama, campaigned on a platform of ending mass surveillance in the United States. He said no more warrantless wiretapping. He said he would investigate and end criminal activities that occurred under the prior administration in the Bush era. We're talking about torture. We're talking about extrajudicial killings. And we all put a lot of hope in him because of this. Not just people in my country, not just myself, but people in Europe and elsewhere around the world. It was a moment where we believed that because the right person got into office, everything would change. But unfortunately, once he took that office, we saw that he didn't actually fulfill those campaign promises. Guantanamo Bay, the secret prison in Cuba, which he had promised to close on the first day of his presidency, is still open and likely will be on the last day of his presidency. He embraced the policies of mass surveillance, extended them, and entrenched them. And this isn't to criticize this president particularly. This is not to say Obama is what we should be worried about. This is to talk about a broader point, which is we should be cautious about putting too much faith or fear in the work of elected officials. At the end of the day, this is just a president. If we want to build or live or enjoy the fruits of a better world, if we want to make sure that the rights that we have encoded into our laws are actually reliable, that we live with them and pass them to our children, this will never be the work of politicians. This can only be the work of the people, of the population, because politicians do not simply do what they think is best. They do what they think people want to hear. They do what they think will gain them support. And ultimately, if we want to see a change, we must force it through ourselves. If we want to have a better world, we can't hope for an Obama, and we should not fear a Donald Trump. Rather, we should build it ourselves.
Okay, other subject. Thank you. A question out of the many questions we got about U.S. companies. U.S. laws like the Patriot Act require U.S. businesses to cooperate with government surveillance. Can we trust U.S. corporations with sensitive information like our email? Or should we prefer non-U.S. companies?
I'm not sure if this is a serious question.
It is.
But I'll answer it as if it were. We have seen real problems with that. There was quite recently, in the wake of June 2013, President Obama going throughout Europe and saying, these newspaper stories that you've heard about all the spying, they're not very well understood. It doesn't mean what you think. The NSA isn't simply rifling through your emails. Mass surveillance doesn't really exist. These are targeted programs. We're only looking for specific people. And yet, only the beginning of last month, October of 2016, we found that one of the largest email service providers in the United States had secretly gone beyond what the law required, and the law does require a lot of these companies, to scan on behalf of the U.S. intelligence community the emails of all of their customers as they come or go for particular pieces of information that were provided by U.S. spy agencies. Now, the question that you should be asking yourself is not, should I trust U.S. companies, which it's clear, unfortunately, in many cases, they can't be trusted, but can you trust your own? Are countries in the Netherlands any better? Are countries, are companies in Germany better? And unfortunately, we see a march of these kind of laws sweeping across Europe right now and more broadly the world. The United Kingdom is in the midst of passing the most extreme surveillance measure in the history of any Western society right now, called the Investigatory Powers Bill, which legitimizes and entrenches mass surveillance in a way that would be unacceptable even in the United States, where we've grown quite comfortable with many of these programs. The Netherlands has similar policies. Norway is debating one right now. Germany claimed to pass a reform package quite recently that actually wasn't a reform package. Instead, it legitimized some of the unlawful programs that occurred before. And what we need to start thinking about is, rather than can we trust any company generally, can we start finding specific, particularized companies that can be trusted? Can we look to business models and business practices of particular institutions, corporations that see you as their primary customer, as seeing you as the one to which they owe the greatest loyalty, rather than to some government, whether it's your own or some foreign government or any other place? And can they prove that this is a relationship that you should trust through their application of technology? I'll simplify this just by demonstrating what I mean in a simpler way. In the midst of that same Yahoo case, we saw there was another telecommunications provider in the United States. This is also October, around the same day. This is an app called Signal, used for sending text messages on your phone or making calls that are encrypted, that are protected, that are electronically clothed. They're armored, like we discussed earlier, as they transit the hostile internet. And the FBI used these laws to go after this company. But rather than doing what Yahoo did and simply giving the government far more than what they asked for, they went to the American Civil Liberties Union, the largest civil rights organization in the United States, and they said, what can we do? And the ACLU said, well, you have to help the government as the law requires, but only what the law requires. And Signal said, well, can we fight this gag order that meant we couldn't tell our customers what was going on? We couldn't tell the public how the government was trying to use our service for the purposes of gathering secret intelligence. And they won. And when they revealed what they actually turned over to the government, it was only this. These black bars are the entirety of the information that they turned over, which are only the phone numbers of the accounts that had been registered with the service, which the government already had. Because the government was saying, hey, pull all the records you have on this phone number. And they said, all right, here are all the records that we kept. And the only information they had was when the account was created and the last time it was connected. Because this company, Signal, this app provider, they weren't spying on their customers. That was not their business model. They weren't collecting records that they could then be forced to turn over. This is very similar to previous times in history when companies had collected a lot of information. But then there were changes, more militarized societies that came over, and then they had to hand over these vast databases of information that were used for the purposes of persecution. We should never enter that kind of world again. And the best way to defend against it is to make sure that you do not collect information as a business that you do not need.
How do you think the awareness of the public is growing or fading already since 2013, since your actions?
Yeah, I mean, it's natural for these things to sort of fade. People don't remember exactly what happened. Many people didn't see the original stories at all. When we go through the kind of things that were demonstrated in 2013, many of you have probably heard of the PRISM program. You've seen it in the film. You know the largest internet companies in the world voluntarily joined this program. You may have also heard about upstream communications, where rather than going to the internet companies themselves, they went to the phone companies. They went to sort of these fiber optic networks that tie the European continent to the American continent, and instead just listened to everything. But you might not have heard of other programs where the NSA was spying on the pornography viewing habits of individuals that they considered to have radical political beliefs. These were Islamists. To be fair, but these were individuals that the NSA's own top secret documents said they did not suspect of violence, and they did not suspect to be actually tied to terrorist activity. They just didn't like their politics. The United Kingdom was collecting images from people's webcams. If you happened to use Yahoo Messenger some years ago when that was a popular thing, the camera that was in your bedroom, they were collecting an image from every 5 minutes, and they were storing it permanently. In Australia, the same infrastructure that the United States government had built, the technology that we had developed and shared, they were using to identify the sources of journalists who had written reports that they considered critical, programs that had been justified on the basis of national security that they said were going to be used strictly for counterterrorism purposes, had instead been used to target U.S. lawyers, which is actually a violation of law. And not because they thought these lawyers had some special intelligence that would save lives, but rather because they were negotiating a trade deal with Indonesia over the price of shrimp and clove cigarettes. These things will fade, but there is one thing that we should remember. When we look at the investigation into the effectiveness of these programs, the U.S. government's own staff, right? These are not sort of liberal reformers. These are not people who want to see an open society. This board was comprised of individuals such as the former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Michael Morell. And they found that this kind of mass surveillance that had been justified on the basis of countering terrorism had actually never been useful in that context. It had never stopped a single terrorist plot. And it had never made, and this is the government's words, a quote, a concrete difference in the outcome of any terrorism investigation. These programs were never about terrorism. They were about economic espionage. They were about diplomatic manipulation. They were about social influence. They're about power. And that's what espionage has always been about. Countering terrorism is not an intelligence activity in the traditional sense. That is a police activity. And when we hear people, when we hear spies, when we hear politicians saying, give up your rights to allow us to create these intelligence infrastructures of extraordinary powers because terrorists exist in the world, you should remember that there have always been terrorists in the past. We have always been able to counter them effectively. And we did this through the traditional means of police work and investigation that have always been effective in the past. Why are we proposing to throw away all of the rights that people fought and died to establish over centuries of human civilization for programs that even the U.S. government says were never effective?
Okay. You say mass surveillance is not productive for attacking terrorist attacks. But their intelligence services need some information, a lot of information, to protect the people, they say, and we believe. So what kind of information and what kind of programs need intelligence services to protect us from bombings like in Boston, like in Paris, like in Brussels? If mass surveillance is not appropriate.
Yeah, this is an excellent question, because when we look at the Boston Marathon bombings, for example, this was during the height of American mass surveillance. This was before anybody knew it existed, before it had hit the newspapers. And they were collecting the phone calls of everyone. They were collecting the internet activities of people indiscriminately, just in case they were useful. And it did not stop this attack. And it did not stop this attack, even though we had been specifically warned by foreign intelligence services that these individuals were associated with terrorism. Much the same in Brussels. Now, we had known about mass surveillance in a broad sense here. But in the Brussels attacks, Belgium had been warned by the Turks, in this case, that some of these individuals were associated with terrorism. So it begs the question, why did mass surveillance fail to catch these individuals? It's not because they used encryption. It's not because they were particularly skillful. It's not because they were just so clever. It's because when you collect everything, the communications of everyone in a nation, you understand nothing. You get drowned in so much information that you can't find what's actually relevant. If you use traditional means of investigation, gathering indicators, tips from, for example, these foreign intelligence services, you take them to a court, you go to a judge, you say, look, we have some evidence. This person has ties to terrorism. We would like a warrant for our police to sneak into their homes, to place a camera, to tap a phone, to follow them as they go through their activities in the day, as we always have decades at this point. You can watch specifically the individuals who exhibit indications of actually threatening behavior, and then you can catch them in the act. And these are the cases where we have seen it happen. In recent Canadian attacks that have been thwarted, it was not due to mass surveillance, but it was because of the fact that they watched specifically the individuals who they had been tipped off did have these activities, often by members of their family or by their communities, and they watched them. And then when suddenly they collect weapons, they call a taxi cab, and they try to go to a train station, the police are already there, ready to make the arrest and ready to thwart the attack, and it actually works. The distinction that I want to make here in simple terms, because I know that's a little bit broad, is what people in civil society, what I protest most strongly, is mass surveillance, indiscriminate surveillance where they're watching everyone, targeted surveillance that's backed by a court where police have shown, look, this individual is more likely than not to be a criminal. We're asking for a warrant to investigate their activities for a period of time in a very intrusive way, but in a very targeted way. We're only watching this individual. We know it is effective because it has been in the past. And we know that this is the least intrusive means of achieving these investigative goals without destroying the rights of everyone else in a free society.
So you say mass surveillance isn't necessary for counter-terror attacks.
That's correct. But let's presume it were. Let's presume it were effective. Would we want it anyway? The challenge here is if we create a government that is so powerful, a structure that is so omniscient, it knows everything that everyone's doing at every time. It can enforce the law perfectly. No one can steal a loaf of bread, no one can speed, no one can commit a terrorist act, no one can murder. A lot of people would say that's fabulous, it's the end of crime, and it's true. But that may not be as unmitigated a good as it seems at first glance. Because when we think about social progress, when we think about the advance of human rights, when we think about the abolition of slavery, when we think about marriage equality, when we think about the prohibition of drugs or certain kinds of alcohol in the past, prohibition of certain types of religious worship, all of these movements were criminal activities in the beginning. Even if it's the enfranchisement of women, allowing them to vote, if government simply says, the laws on the books can be enforced, and they will be enforced, and we will use the full extent of our powers to ensure that is the case. What they're doing is they're halting progress at this moment in time and saying, we have gone far enough, And no one can transgress against the status quo, even for a good reason. No one can organize to change the law if, to do so, they have to love someone in a way that's not approved. They have to worship in a way that's not popular. They have to do any activity that has not been explicitly authorized in advance by the government. I do not see that as a bright future. In fact, I see it as a very dark one.
I really like to ask you what we can do about that. But first, this is quite a bad situation where we're in now. But I want to make it worse, because I have a question about the way, let's see, where have I the question? Yeah, the technology develops enormously. Everybody can buy the software to spy on one another. So how can we stop Big Brother before we going paranoid?
Yeah, so this is a very complex technical question. And I'm very comfortable saying that as of today, we don't have an answer. We have ideas, we have directions for research, but this is not a solved problem. And for the young people in the audience, this is a problem that you could solve. What we're seeing today is the atomic moment of computer science. We're living through it. What nuclear physics had in the last century, we are seeing for this discipline, computer science, today in our lifetimes. Technologies that we expected to be a benefit for all of mankind are being subverted. They're being corrupted in subtle ways to work contrary to those purposes. And we have to find a way today to change that direction and make it serve humanity rather than master humanity. And the ideas that we're looking at here are for simple methods to do things that we've never really considered before. For example, encryption, as we've talked about before, protects what you said on a phone call as it crosses the internet. It protects what was written in a text message. It protects your picture so no one can see it if you share a photograph with someone. But it does not disguise the fact that you sent a photograph or made a phone call or made a purchase or visited a website or necessarily bought this book from a bookseller online. And these things on their own can be very dangerous. These types of activities are called metadata, right? And these communications or these records about your activity, even encrypted communications, are private activity records, right? But they have no meaningful legal protections today. So even governments in countries that aren't so bad about mass surveillance, even in the Netherlands, for example, the metadata of your activities can often be collected even without the involvement of a court. And this means you can create perfect records of private lives without ever reading what was actually said in the message. The way to change this is we have to find ways to protect not only the content of the communication in that text message or phone call, but to disguise the fact that the communication ever happened at all, the fact that this phone called this phone should be invisible to the vast majority.
But will that happen one day? Is there a technical possibility there is, perhaps, or not?
We have seen methods of disguising this already. There's what's called the Tor protocol, which is a method of what's called a mixed routing network. It's not perfect, and in fact, it cannot protect against the full cooperation of all of these governments on Earth because they can just trade the different parts they see. But what it does is instead of sending your communications from here to here, this computer to this computer, it sort of bounces them around the world in a lot of jurisdictions. So you can't see the direct relationship. But this is very crude. This is like inventing the very first wheel, which is kind of a rock that sort of rolls, but not in a very effective manner. But as we refine these capabilities, as we look for more models of achieving the same ends, it is perhaps possible. And the easiest way to illustrate this is the way that radio frequency broadcasts work. For example, if you think of the prior generation or as you listen to music in your car, there's a tower somewhere that's sending communications and anyone can hear them, but there's no record of who was actually listening, who actually received the signal. That's not to say this is an effective means for resolving our problems today in this context, but there are many things that we thought impossible problems in the past. But eventually, through dedication, by pursuing the problem, and by recognizing that these things matter, we found solutions.
Can you name three very practical things how we all can protect ourselves today for spying, by spying by other people, other corporations, governments?
Certainly. The first thing would be careful about what you share with large service providers. When you're talking about Google, when you're talking about Facebook, everything you type in that Google prompt is being stored and saved forever. You know, they're not asking you if you want that. They're just doing that. There are alternatives like StartPage and other providers that don't store that information. There are social networks that are not Facebook.
Edward Snowden, you say don't use Google? You say that?
I say if you can avoid these things, right? This is all a case for you. You have to decide for yourself what the level of convenience versus threat truly is. But the idea here is you want to control what kind of records are being created and stored about your activities. But more broadly here, we don't want to get into a point by point of doing this, doing that, using this service, not using that service. You want to talk about broad technological capabilities. The first thing you can do is encrypt your devices. If you have a newer iPhone, it's already happening invisibly. If you're using an Android phone, you can go into the settings and encrypt your phone. So if it's lost, a criminal can't just open it and read everything. Use two-factor authentication. We've seen recent hacks about the election in the United States and other things like that, where someone will send you an email that appears that it comes from Google. It looks identical. So you click it, you type in your password, and now someone else has gained access to your account. There's something called two-factor authentication, which you could use for if you do use Google, for example, your Gmail account, that will require something like another code that comes from a token where you just tap it on your phone and it gives you a code that you can enter. So if someone does this to you, you won't be affected by it, or it sends you a text message. There are many things you can do. Use Signal, that kind of application for protecting your text messages, for protecting your phone calls. Use Tor when you're browsing on the internet. The Tor browser won't give you perfect security, but you will be far safer than if you were using a normal Internet Explorer or Chrome or Firefox browser. And these kind of things lead us to a larger point, which is you as an individual should not have to do this. You should not have to make these decisions. You should not have to study to be safe using the devices that you rely upon every day. And this means you have to be political. You have to talk about these things. You have to recognize, right, that when somebody says, you know, don't worry about this, it doesn't matter. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, they're misleading you, they're deceiving you, they're disempowering you. Because privacy isn't about something to hide, it's about something to protect. Privacy is the right to the self, right? Privacy is the right to a free mind. Privacy is the foundation of all other rights. Freedom of speech doesn't mean very much if you can't try out in a safe space among friends without the judgment of this external society what it is that you actually think and figure, is this a good idea, is this a bad idea? Freedom of religion, the same thing. You either inherit a religion or you accept it from the state, but you don't know what it is for yourself that you actually believe in and who you want to become unless you have that protected space. And moreover, right, privacy is not intended for the majority. That's not where it derives its value from. Politicians don't need privacy. They're already powerful. They can already defend themselves. The majority can reshape society to their will. They don't need it that much. But minorities, vulnerable populations, people who are a little bit different, people who are a little bit unusual, people who don't fit in, even in a small way, if you disagree with the majority opinion, you are the one that privacy is for. And this is why, you know, when you hear people say things like that, say back, if you argue, you know, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. That's no different than saying you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say. It's an antisocial argument that says it doesn't matter what happens to the rest of society. It doesn't matter what happens to my rights because I'm okay right now. I'm not different. I'm not interesting. And I don't need to be. I'll adapt to whatever the rest of the world wants. And what you're saying is, I don't want freedom. I don't want liberty. I just want to be. And while you might agree with that, I think we can be better. I think we can do more, and I think we should. I think the rights that we inherited are a blessing, something that we should protect and defend and ensure that not just this generation, but every other generation enjoys that and more.
Do we care enough today?
I think we do. I think the fact that we have so many people in this room, I think the fact that we have so many people joining us throughout the internet, I think the fact that we have so many people talking about this election and its implications for the world says that people do care. The difference is many people have been convinced that there's nothing they can do about it. It's not that we don't care, it's that we feel disempowered. It's not that, you know, people think, Donald Trump is the greatest person in the United States. It's the fact that maybe they did not prefer the other option. And this is a challenge. We should never be asked as a society to pick between one or the other. Do you want this or that? We need to work cooperatively. We need to work together to build institutions that don't think about candidates, that don't think about a choice of bad options. But instead give us a world that we design, that we build, that we realize step by step, right? You don't just inherit the past and expect it to continue. You don't just elect a politician with a vote, or if you disagree, if you're in the minority, or in the case of the United States, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but somehow she didn't end up being president. That one's still to be explained. The challenge here is that that does not end the extent of your involvement. You are more than a vote. You are more than a check in a box. What you do today creates tomorrow. And if you don't start thinking about what you're going to do tomorrow, if you don't start thinking about the day after the election, the year after the election, and every other, you are not thinking about what being a citizen truly means. A vote is a start. A vote matters, but it will never be enough.
I want to talk a moment about your own privacy and freedom at the moment. You said to BBC Panorama, and you said it... Did you hear that?
I can't. I'm sorry.
Okay.
No microphone.
I explained the question. It was a question out of the room here, and he said, "Well, what can we do? I did vote, and it's not enough. What can we do more?"
This is a great question. So a lot of people ask this because they think about, you know, a lot of the conversation that's happening politically, particularly in the field of privacy, is an expert conversation. We're being excluded from it, not necessarily through a plan, although that does happen in some circumstances, but because it's too hard, it's too difficult. It takes a lot of study and understanding of obscure technology or arcane mathematics. And then, of course, the politicians don't listen to the experts at all and just do their own thing. How do we ensure we have a say? And the idea here is you can't be expected to dedicate all of this time, all of this study, to every single issue on earth. What you can do is that you say you care, you can talk to your family, you can talk to your community to raise awareness of things, and then you can act to make sure that those people who are experts have the ability, they have the platform, they have the resources, they have the support to actually achieve it. If you don't have the time to protest, support an organization that will. Send money to a group that has a history of standing up for civil liberties. Send money to groups that will actually sue governments to enforce the law. And when the law fails, when we find out that the law is not enough, that the law is only the smallest guarantee of our rights, support technology, corporations, groups, and individuals who are trying to enforce your rights directly through science, through math, through technology, to ensure that any government anywhere must respect your rights, because no amount of violence, no amount of military force will ever solve a math problem.
Does that answer your question? Okay, plenty to do, though, so. Now I want to ask you some questions about your own privacy and your own freedom at the moment. You said in a BBC documentary, in an interview, and also in the movie we saw it, you are willing to go back to the United States to stand trial and to go to jail. What do you want in return for that?
Yeah, I've made it clear from the very beginning that I only have a single condition, and that's that I receive a fair trial. Now, what does that mean? That means being able to tell the jury why it is that you did what you did, and for them to decide, is this man truly guilty in a way that he should be sent to prison, or was this the right thing to do? And this is why we have jury trials. But the United States government charged me under very specific laws that are quite unusual in the United States, specifically to prohibit me being able to speak to a jury and tell them why it is that I did what I did. This, of course, is called the Espionage Act, a law that was intended to be used for people working as foreign spies. But they have used it increasingly against journalists in recent history and their sources in a way that's unprecedented. James Risen, one of the most famous reporters of the New York Times, called the current president's war on whistleblowers a policy that makes him the greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation. And it's not just him. This is not an isolated case. The executive editor of the New York Times, which is the largest newspaper in the United States, which is a very liberal, very pro-Obama newspaper. You know, these aren't sort of radical critics or anything like that. They said that the Obama White House is the most secretive they've ever dealt with. When I asked the government this, and I said, look, you know, as long as you let me talk to a jury, I'll come back. Let's have this. Let's have the people decide. They sent back a letter saying, we promise we will not torture you. And, you know, while that is a start, I think we can do better than that. And I think we should.
Yeah. So do you see yourself returning to the United States one day?
I certainly hope so.
You hope it?
Yeah. I mean, it has always been my desire to return to my home. It is my home, right? What I won't do is I won't stand up and serve as a deterrent willingly to scare people away from doing the right thing. If people work in government and they see criminal activities occurring, and they say something about it, that should not itself be a crime. And I want to be clear that this is exactly what happened. Before I came forward 4 months prior, the Supreme Court of the United States was asked by these civil liberties organizations to rule on the lawfulness of these surveillance activities. And they said, it's very interesting, but we can't, because we can't prove that it actually happened, or you can't prove that it happened. The government said it's a secret. But after I came forward, the same courts found that, in fact, the NSA's activities had broken the law. They had done so for more than a decade. They were likely unconstitutional. The president himself signed reforms into law. The United Nations found that these programs were a violation of human rights. The European Union passed a resolution saying that whistleblowers should be protected from this kind of political persecution. They should not be extradited when they have worked in the public service in good faith to reveal activities of public concern. And the question is there a reason that you think I should not be hopeful? I think despite the challenges that we have in the United States, despite changes in government, despite some of the very concerning statements made by our new president-elect, this is a nation that will strive to get better. This is a dark moment in our nation's history. but it is not the end of history. And if we work together, we can build something better, and we can enjoy a more free and more liberal society that benefits everyone, and prove once and for all that America has a greater commitment to justice than it does simply to the law.
The new president-elect gets along a bit better with Putin than Clinton. Do you feel any anxiety, any fear perhaps, that Trump will be the new president of the United States because of his good relationships with Putin?
I don't worry about it. It's possible, right? It would be crazy to dismiss the idea of this guy who presents himself as a big deal maker of trying to make a deal. Now, the president of Russia has previously said on camera that the people of Russia consider me a human rights defender. And regardless of the position that we have on Russian politics, which obviously have a lot of problems, they said Russia is not a country that extradites human rights defenders. But let's say that weren't true. Let's say some kind of deal was made. Let's say all of that turned around and I was sent away. If I was worried about safety, if the security and the future of sort of myself was all that I cared about, I would still be in Hawaii. I never expected it to make it out of Hawaii when I came forward in June of 2013. The fact that I ever did still surprises me today. But the bottom line is this: I'm comfortable with the choices that I made. I'm proud of the choices that I made. I think I did the right thing. And wow, you know, I can't predict what the future looks like. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I can be comfortable with the way that I've lived to today. And no matter what happens, right? If there's a drone strike that comes tomorrow, if, you know, they put together some operation, I slip and fall down the stairs. That's something that won't change. I think as long as we do our best to live in accordance with our values, we don't have to worry about what happens tomorrow, because today is enough.
For me, the last question, if you look to the rest of your life, what do you see?
Well, so far it's going pretty well, I've got to say. I actually feel more connected. I feel like I have more ability to change the world for the better today than when I was working secretly for the NSA. There was a very long time in the intelligence community where I had no questions about my work. I was proud of what I did. And even in Hawaii, when I came forward, I didn't think the NSA was full of mustache-twirling villains, right? That the place should be burned down, that operations should be shuttered entirely. I felt that there were parts that had gone too far. And there's a lot that I did that I'm still proud of. There's a lot of work of my colleagues that I'm proud of. And I think they do a very valuable thing for the world when they do it in a way that respects people's rights. But today, for me as an individual, I can give a voice to the side of the NSA that is forbidden from speaking. Remember, if you say these things and you work for the United States intelligence community, you go to jail for 10 years for every single statement that you make that they consider to be classified. This is a role that has been missing for far too long. And although, you know, I would eventually like to do other things, I'm very thankful for the role that I'm able to play today. And I hope it provides as much benefit to as many other people as the enjoyment that it provides for me. I mean, I am pretty fulfilled.
Thank you very much, Edwin Snowden.
Thank you.
I wish you the best wishes, and your courage will inspire us to the good thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, and have a good night.
And stay cool.
Stay true. Good night.
Thank you all very much. This was the end of the evening. On behalf of startpage.com, who made this discussion and this conversation possible, a very good night. Well done.